The 60th anniversary of the Tallahassee bus boycott was observed earlier this week. Gerald Inslee will be with me here in the first hour, and Kenneth Pratt in the second hour to talk about race relations in Tallahassee. If you've ever wondered about music therapy, how all that works, well, we've got Stephanie Tassos talking with us, so stay with me.
Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, brought to you by Widen Glass, Tallahassee's first name in glass for your home or office, and by Merry Maids. Call Merry Maids. Relax. And it's done.
American Commerce. Visionary. Hardworking. Innovative. Reaching higher. Investing more. Giving more. This is American Commerce. It's an ideal that has inspired the world to dream and believe that we can all do better. American Commerce Bank believes just that. That we can all do better. We can achieve the goals that small business owners aspire to every day. Providing these owner-managed businesses with the tools and services they count on. Creating opportunity. Providing leadership and direction to help them grow. To inspire them to believe in more. This is American Commerce Bank, right here in Tallahassee, and right now offering 2% annual percentage yield on 60-month certificates of deposit. That's reaching higher. That's American Commerce Bank. Online at AmericanCommerceBank.com. Rates are effective as of August 15, 2016, and are subject to change without notice. New money only. Minimum balance $500. APY assumes principal and interest remain on deposit until maturity. A penalty may be imposed for early withdrawal. American Commerce Bank, Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC.
Well, I'm glad you're back with me, my friend, because it makes it possible for me to keep you informed of all of these happenings around town. And as we endeavor to do, we find the very coolest people doing the very coolest things, because I find it that it keeps me from getting really depressed about so many things that trouble me, among which are those events related to current times when it comes to race relations around the country, and when we look at the kind of events that have occurred and the manner in which those are being dealt with, both individually and collectively, by law enforcement, by those involved in various groups like Black Lives Matter, when we see for ourselves in our community where we are, we're reminded that in 1956, the Tallahassee bus boycott really laid the groundwork. It was the demarcation, if you want. It was the point at which the most, at least to date, as of that date, the most demonstrable attempt had been made to say, we're not going to do this anymore. We need to call, we're calling for change. And we're going to ask Gerald Inslee, who has joined us in this first hour, to fill in all the details as to not only how that happened, why it happened at that time, and what significance that brought to what was then the beginnings of the civil rights movement as we came to know it under the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King. The Montgomery boycott had preceded this occurrence in Tallahassee, but it at the same time asks us all to reconsider, where have we come? What kinds of progress have we made? What kinds of things do we think of now when we look at advantages and disadvantages for anyone within any given grouping? And so, particularly because the events in our nation's experience in the last several months have been so troubling, right? The shootings that have occurred, the protests that have been rallied, the violence that has erupted. It has then, for us here in Tallahassee, begged the question, are we not subject to the same kinds of things happening here? And if we are, what can we do to dissuade that? How do we make further advances in the business of quelling a kind of racial stereotyping or gender stereotyping, or even, may I say this too, political stereotyping. It seems to me that we're fond of organizing ourselves into various categories and groups. You know, the social psychologist among us would tell us that it is a human thing to do, to think stereotypically as a matter of convenience. It seems to be inherent in the species that we are likely to want to treat every experience in a categorical way, just less work. So, you know, a rock is a rock is a rock. A flower is a flower. And so when we find ourselves falling into these lines of thought that are accustomed to us, it's easier then for us to rely on those prejudged definitions. That prejudgment in and of itself is, again, a sort of, let's say, a human characteristic, if you want to call it a habit, if you want to call it an entrenched attitude, okay? When we're challenged in that thinking, something moves us out of that routine, that particular route, that particular conclusion that we draw, that perception that is the most immediate on any variable. I mean, everything from hair to toenails, right? We're quick to be able to come to some ready solution, some conclusion that we've put on our shelf. That's where we go and say, ah, well, look at him. We know what he's all about. Heck, look at the bumper stickers on his car. There we go. So, of course, if we are to depart from such categorical thinking, stereotypic conclusions, one might suggest, and I'm suggesting it, that conversation, open conversation, respectful conversation, we call it civil discourse, right? It's not a bad way to go. Do I sound like I'm preaching? Yes. Are you sick of hearing me preach about this? I don't care, because it's worth preaching about. It's the stuff that we care about mostly here, because it means that you have opportunity to say exactly what you want to say. And that's kind of how it rolls. When I invite folks to come to my studio and I sit here and I listen to them, I want to hear their story. I want to hear what it is that they're doing that is part of our fabric. And that discovery brings me to somebody like Kenneth Platt or somebody like Gerald Inslee. Gerald, for his part, did a pretty good job in recalling for us the details of this historic event, and it was historic. It led to all sorts of other changes that came about. I think that could be argued. But it came at the right time, too, because here we were in the mid-50s heading into what would end up being a decade or better of civil rights activities, even federal legislation that came about ultimately. Well, where are we in Tallahassee today? We've asked Kenneth Platt to join us because we think that he has a particular vantage point that will be illustrative. And he was asked to speak at this commemorative observance at, was it Trinity United Methodist? I forget. Well, he'll tell us. He was at one of the churches here in town. I want to say it was Trinity United Methodist. Maybe it was the Presbyterian Church in downtown Tallahassee. In any case, at that observance, he brought certain remarks and observations, I should say, that were helpful in better appreciating where we are right now. Where is Tallahassee in its quest to ensure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all of us Tallahasseans? All right, as promised, I've got standing by Andrew Rybeck with what you'll be doing this week. Andrew?
All right, guys, I hope you had a fun time last week. This week, I have some more fun events for you to take on. Do you think you're funny? Well, this Wednesday, October 5th, the Midtown Arts and Entertainment Rehearsal Studio will open their doors for a two-hour improv workshop. Well, actually, they do this every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., but you get the point. This course is an all-inclusive workshop to learn and perform short-form improvisation games, with fun being the main objective. You can find Midtown Arts at 537 D Silver Slipper Lane, or just visit their website. There is a suggested donation of $5. So last week I made mention of clog dancing classes, and I know that your feet might want to rest, but I also know that your passion for dance still burns deep, so don't fret, I got you covered. The Killarn Performing Arts Studio is known for their Irish step dancing, right? Well, they want to include you and get you in on the action. They have classes for all age groups at all different times, including mixed age classes, a kids class, and even a preschool class. It's only $45 a month, and that includes classes every week. They do offer discounts for enrollment in multiple classes or if you enroll multiple family members. Their website is kpadance.com, and you can find the list of the classes they offer there. So be sure to check that out and get your jig on. That's what you'll be doing this week. For Tallahassee Talks, I'm Andrew Rybeck.
Witten Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. Local contractors know Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. They prefer Witten Glass because of their precise window glass replacement, masterful shower enclosures, and storefront glass. Witten Glass will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. That's been Witten's way of doing business for 65 years. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. We've done hundreds of storefronts in the Tallahassee area. That's why Witten is known for taking care of business. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
Changing the face of talk radio in Tallahassee. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So here we are, friends. We have with us Steffi Tassos Wulsifer, our good friend, who has been the friend of many for many years in this whole realm of music performance as a performer and music educator. And of late, she has been providing music therapy, which I find particularly interesting. She's got a website called Keep Safe Music, keepsafemusic.com. So you can learn all about what she's done and is doing. She does jingles and voiceovers. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
We're glad that you're here. And she's brought with us one of her keyboards, and this is your primary instrument, is it not?
It's the instrument that I majored in when I went to music school.
Yeah, and where was that?
That was in Syracuse University and also at Manhattanville College.
Orange, okay,
yeah,
cool.
Orange.
Yeah. Well, so with your working as a musician, performer, and such, it led you to this point at which, I think you said 4 years ago, you began doing music therapy, which I find particularly interesting, because I personally have a background in having done mental health work and marriage and family therapy and such. So I'm trying to imagine how I could have incorporated music into all of that therapy that I had done for clients. How does it work? How does music therapy provide, I guess you'd say, therapeutic value?
Well, first of all, as a music therapist, you just can't wake up one day and decide to do it. There is a study that you have to go through and a certification, and which took me about 2 years to get, and I got from FSU, which has a wonderful music therapy program, and then you sit for an exam and you get certified and you maintain your certification like anyone else that has a certification. You have to take continuing ed classes, and so anyway, that's how I came to it. And I've worked as a music therapist. I have worked with people with disabilities. And also in mental health. I worked up at Chattahoochee for a while. And then I'm kind of semi-retired, you know, but I have a lot of private students. Right. And music therapy has made me a better teacher. I can't say that I have any of my students are, quote, music therapy clients.
Oh, yeah.
But I do incorporate a lot of what I learned as a music therapist into my teaching.
I believe
it's made me a better teacher.
Okay, so it's a sort of a reflexive thing. You know, one led to the other, and now your background as a therapist is helping you as an instructor.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who may be unacquainted with the, let's say, the import of music therapy. When you look at somebody and say, boy, you could really use my help. I mean, how do you know that? And then what do you do? Sit me down and sing songs to me? I mean,
well,
not to make light of it. I'm just saying, you know, it seems to be, I would imagine it to be a lot more,
there's more to it than
thoughtful
that.
Than that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with, I mean, sitting down and singing songs with people is always a wonderful thing to do.
I mean,
you know, you can do it in anywhere.
A few drinks and a few songs. I'm good, man. I mean, I find that therapeutic.
As the Irish say, you know, let's have a wee bit of a sing. You know?
But I've been told I'm well beyond the realm of finding anything that could help me. But for the people that you have helped, how did you know that your approach would be effective, or did you?
Well, some people will come with that in mind, that they want music therapy.
Wow.
And other people don't necessarily know that. I recently did a group music therapy session with a group of people who were, I'm trying to think, they were kind of from all walks of life.
Really?
But there was one gentleman in the group that made it very clear that he did not want to be there. And he said, I don't like music. I've never liked music. I don't get music. And I really don't want to be here. So... And I just handed out some song sheets, and I said, well, why don't you just stick around for a while since these are all your friends.
All right, if I were that guy, and I'm in that, and you've got your keyboard in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I had a guitar that day.
Well, okay, fine.
Yeah.
So show me now what that would amount to. How would you proceed?
I would just proceed by, let's say, giving them a song, and a song that I like to start with, especially if it's with a senior group, is a song that absolutely everybody in this country seems to know, and that's You Are My Sunshine.
Right.
I mean, just everybody knows
okay.
that.
Okay, I'm ready. And I need this, believe me. This is a day for this.
So I might give you a little introduction, say, okay, everybody, this is going to be You Are My Sunshine.
And do I need to sing along with you?
You have to sing with me, Brian.
I do.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You're doing great. You make me happy when times are great. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't
take
my sunshine away.
Don't forget to tip your waitress.
Yeah.
Okay. See, already.
All right. See, there you
I've
go.
I've brightened up. I think I can do this. Music therapy, huh?
So anyway, so this particular, I want to get back to this fellow, because he was just sitting there and he was looking at the lyrics. He didn't leave.
Yeah.
I mean, he was free to leave. And all of a sudden his lips start going.
Uh-huh.
So he's kind of reading the lyrics along. So to make a long story short, he never left. You know, it was about a 45-minute session, and he didn't leave. He stopped complaining. He took the lyric sheets, and he just kind of mumbled along to himself, and that was the way that he took part in the group.
Okay, so the efficacy of this practice is its rather delicate way of helping somebody then, what, open up a bit?
Socialize.
Yeah.
And
getting
just maybe try something that maybe, you know, you may be sitting there going like, all right, this isn't so bad after all.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
it's
music
disarming
is okay.
In that way,
yeah.
Especially when it's a song like You Are My Sunshine.
Right.
Very clever.
Yeah.
What other cool songs do you do?
let me see. A lot of requests are songs like, you know, Jimmy Buffett. Everybody loves Jimmy Buffett.
Absolutely.
Tunes, you know,
right.
And
Margaritaville. Sure.
Yeah. Although when I used to work, sometimes I do work with people dealing with substance abuse. You know, so they would say avoid songs like Margaritaville.
Things about tequila probably aren't appropriate.
Yeah.
But then again,
but if they want to hear it, you know, hey, it's if they want to sing along to it, then who am I to say no? I'm sorry, we can't sing
can't
along
do that
because
today.
It's about tequila. But
well, this is very interesting, folks. We're listening to the works of and the practice of Steffi Tasos Wulcifer. And we have to keep saying that because Bill's going to get his feelings hurt if I don't include his last name. All of you know Bill Wulcifer and for his contributions to our community. But this is not your turn, Bill. This is Steffi's turn. And what a delight. You know, we're coming up to the end of this moment on the show, and so what I'm going to ask Steffi to do for me is to stay with me. We'll do part two next week, and that way we'll continue this conversation. Steffi, thank you for being with us.
You are so welcome. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks, stay with me. We've got more Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny coming up right after this.
Because the truth is, the best medicine is a good, healthy life. It's challenging to do, but there are small changes that we can make.
Dr. Mignon talking about helping you maintain your health.
People know what to do, but they don't know how to get it done. And even when we know what to do, it's difficult to make it happen. I just know how important it is because I see, as a physician, I know the bad things. And I know it's a heck of a lot better if we can just prevent that. But we got to, you know, we start small and they evolve into bigger changes. If that's exercise, so we offer exercise services or nutritional counseling and modifying our diet. You know, it's not just about medicine and your cholesterol, but it's about what you do, what you eat, and helping people to see that connection and really make that change.
Dr. Mignon with Health and Wellness Centers of North Florida, welcoming Blue Cross Blue Shield patients. 850-656-2006 or TallahasseeHealthandWellness.com.
More beauty, less bully. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Welcome back. We are privileged to have with us Gerald Inslee, who, for his contributions to our understanding and even our education, sometimes our amusement, has been famous for his work with the Tallahassee Democrat over these many years. It seems as though just about the time he's ready to leave the room, they keep dragging him back in there. He and Bill Cotterill, apparently, you know, you just can't let these guys go. But let's welcome Gerald Inslee to the show. How are you, sir?
Doing fine, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk.
You're looking good.
Thank you.
Your work with the newspaper and for those many years that you were involved really began, if I'm not mistaken, as a sports reporter in the Carolinas?
I started here as a sports writer with the Tallahassee Democrat. I was a sports writer for the first eight-plus years, although I continued to write a sports column for another five or six, even after I went to the news side.
Yeah.
But I started as a sports writer.
And then, you were even a part of the student publication,
yes,
too.
Yes, I was a sports editor of the Florida Flambeau, the independent newspaper at FSU.
Look at that. Yeah. So you've watched this town unfold and grow and discover itself. I'm fond of saying that, to me, Tallahassee is a teenage girl who has arrived at that point in life when she's in her adolescence, beginning to question a lot of her own history and looking at, is this who I really am? So there's kind of awakening going on.
There's certainly an awakening going on.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe this is a segue into what we're going to talk about, but I say all the time that the biggest change from when I came in 1969 to today is the improvement in race relations. And all that started 13 years before I came with the Tallahassee bus boycott in 1956.
In fact.
But this was a very old South town. And you talk about the awakening and the changes, and there's many of those. Many of them have nothing to do with race. But it is the growth and the improvement of race relations that has been the most significant advance in this town.
And in fact, this bus boycott that we're talking about, this is the 60th anniversary celebration of the 1956 bus boycott. Right. And that happened because we had these two FAMU students. Let's see if I can get these names correctly. You say them.
Carrie Patterson.
Yeah.
And Wilhelmina Jakes.
Wilhelmina Jakes. There we go.
They were two FAMU students.
Yeah.
In fact, they lived together in a rooming house over on Jennings Street, very near the FAMU campus.
Yeah.
And on May 26, 1956, the two of them went to board the bus at what is now FAMU Way and Adams Street. And they immediately sat down on a bench seat right behind the driver where a white woman was also sitting. The driver immediately said, "You have to move." They said they weren't. He said, "You have to move." They said, "Well, give us our dimes back." He refused to give them their dimes back. I mean, it was a dime fare in those days. Apparently, having put it in the machine or whatever they had in those days, he felt he could not return those dimes. So when they refused to move without their dimes, he drove them to the police station and had them arrested. And that kicked off the boycott. I mean, many things followed. The next night, a fiery cross was burned in the yard of the home where the two girls were staying. That was on a Sunday night. Then on Monday morning, an infuriated student body led by student government president Brodus Hartley. They called a meeting at Lee Hall. At those days, FAMU had only something like 2,200 students. Mm. But anyway, most of the 2,200 students arrived at Lee Hall, and Hartley called for a boycott of the buses, thinking that that would be a good protest back. I don't know. I don't think he was thinking of the historical context, which was that, you know, it already happened in Baton Rouge and happened in Montgomery.
Right, right.
But maybe it was. But mainly he was reacting to the agency, if you will, that had denied two FAMU students their human rights.
Right, yeah. In fact, with the work that had already been done, right, mm-hmm. and this occurrence, you mentioned Montgomery, Rosa Parks and all, do you think there was for them a bit of inspiration?
Possibly.
Okay.
I've got to say, I mean, I don't know how much of the story you want me to tell, but
as much as you can.
Okay. Well, the students started the boycott, and that was on a Monday in late May. There was only 1 week left in the term, in a time when students went away at summer. Nowadays, you know, you've got to take at least one or two summer semesters to graduate. And so the town doesn't empty out like it did in the old days. The old days, colleges closed, they were empty. Yeah. Okay, so in this case, the students are there for 1 week, and presumably they didn't ride the bus much for that 1 week, but then they were gone. So the boycott would have died had it been left up to the students, not because they wanted to, but because they just weren't there, they were gone.
Yeah.
What happened was on that Tuesday after the Monday decision by students was that a group of black pastors and businessmen gathered and formed the Inter-Civic Council. And it was this group.
And that was Reverend Steele.
That was he was elected president. But it was that group, led by Reverend Steele, that really maintained, propelled, and made the boycott happen. And
do you think they, as a group, recognized the historic significance of what they were doing?
I think they possibly recognized the historic significance. To me, the bigger thing is the courage it took. These were middle-aged, middle-class people, dependent on the kindness of white people. Most of them, Steele and the businessmen, that's why they were able to form this, because they weren't dependent on white people. You had grocer Dan Speed, whose clientele was mostly black. You had the black preachers who were paid mostly by their pastorages.
Yeah, yeah.
So the leaders of the thing were probably thinking of the historic part. The ones that joined them, the maids and laborers who came to support them, who came to drive cars to take people to work, these people had to have a certain amount of courage, because what they were doing was attacking their employers.
Yeah.
I mean, not specifically, but they ran the risk of being fired and losing their jobs.
Yeah.
The pastors didn't necessarily, but those who participated in the boycott ran the risk of infuriating the white people for whom they depended on for their economy.
Yeah.
So I think later on, the Tallahassee Civil Rights Movement will be guided by students, mostly FAMU students, Patricia Stevens Due, and all those. But students faced no real consequences for their lives, other than being arrested or being beaten or
something like that.
Right. For these middle-aged people, they were risking their entire families and their economies to take this first step, because Tallahassee has not had that first step.
Interestingly, too, you bring this out in the article that the import of their action was especially pointed because the vast majority of those who rode the bus
were black. Right.
And so for this black community to say, we're out,
right,
that meant that this private company, which in those days it was,
right? City Strange, it was private at that time, right.
They just lost the majority of their customer base. So there was inherently then an economic pressure.
Sure.
So the people owning the bus company had to say, whoops, okay, maybe we're going to have to rethink this.
And it indeed was the bus company that was willing to capitulate sooner than the city commission was. The bus company the bus company agreed to one of the three demands of the protesters, which was to hire black drivers. They did that fairly soon in the process. And the bus company was willing to let them ride anywhere they wanted, except the city commission wouldn't. The city commission passed an ordinance for a while, and it was called assigned seating. And that was, the bus driver was supposed to assign the passengers to a seat based on weight and height. I mean, like, somehow four 200-pound people on one side of the bus was your way down or something like that. So it was the city commission that fought it harder than city transits because, as you note, it was an economic thing. They couldn't afford to keep losing money. They were willing to revisit, if you will, the idea of who sat where and who drove the buses. So, it was an economic thing for them. But for the city commission, this was the first salvo in, we're going to change the way things have been. And that's what they feared. They feared that the city commission felt, if we give in on this, how much longer before they want to go to the same schools? How much longer before they start marrying our women?
So in that way, it was a seminal event.
Yes.
Folks, we're talking with Gerald Ensley. We are in recognition of the 60th anniversary of the Tallahassee bus boycott. And you are in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. Stay with me.
American Commerce. Visionary. Hardworking. Innovative. Reaching higher. Investing more. Giving more. This is American Commerce. It's an ideal that has inspired the world to dream and believe that we can all do better. American Commerce Bank believes just that. That we can all do better. We can achieve the goals that small business owners aspire to every day. Providing these owner-managed businesses with the tools and services they count on. Creating opportunity. Providing leadership and direction to help them grow. To inspire them to believe in more. This is American Commerce Bank, right here in Tallahassee, and right now offering 2% annual percentage yield on 60-month certificates of deposit. That's reaching higher. That's American Commerce Bank. Online at AmericanCommerceBank.com. Rates are effective as of August 15, 2016, and are subject to change without notice. New money only. Minimum balance $500. APY assumes principal and interest remain on deposit until maturity. A penalty may be imposed for early withdrawal. American Commerce Bank, Equal Housing Lender. Member FDIC.
Now we're really talking. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
In 1956, the Tallahassee bus boycott drew a line in the sand when it came to race relations and civil rights, especially as it was focused on the use of what was then a privately owned bus company. Gerald Ensley is with us, and Gerald, we've talked a little bit about some of the particulars, some of the history as to how this came about. When you look forward, and you said this in your opening remarks with us, the number of years that have passed, even since your arrival in Tallahassee, you said that the changes we've made in race relations are probably the most significant in our time. And we're going to have Kenneth Pratt with us in the second hour to talk even more in more greater detail then about where we are now. We've made progress.
Because your question was, will it go away? And apparently it won't go away with a certain segment of the economy,
and
for
so
one thing.
And so then what is required of us who are not of that mind? How do we better, if we can't eliminate it, how do we control
it? I hope it's by the continued good example of good people doing the right things. Mm-hmm. That make it harder and harder for bad people to do the wrong things, and that even if it's in their head, they have less and less opportunity to do anything about it. And you've got to give some credit to the passage of time. There are people now who are in the good segment. Let's say 80% of the white population is in the good segment. I would say 50 years ago, maybe only 20%.
Well, and to your point, when we look around the country and look at the vast number of communities, including our own, we don't see daily or even on a consistent basis of some kind shootings of young black men.
Right.
It's happened in a few communities.
Right.
So it almost underscores your point there, mm-hmm. that you're going to have these elements of racism showing up.
Right.
And when we look at that, what went on in Charlotte was, to me, a sort of mix of violence that often you would just associate with rioting. And then you had those who seemed to be a lot more concerned about the protest and making their point that beyond the reactionary aspects, we've got a much larger issue at stake.
Right.
Is that a fair assessment, you think? I mean,
are you saying that most of the population wants peace and goodness on earth.
I think so.
Yeah, I think I'm saying that. So.
And I'm saying
it's the reason why I hope Hillary is going to be elected.
Well, and I think that the people who you mentioned, the 15 young black men who were put up there and said these are black teenagers. Does it help their cause, whether it's Black Lives Matter or our cause, to say, can't we all get along?
Right.
When we have people who are looting and rioting and burning and such, that seems to me to reinforce all of that. See people going, aha, see, there you go.
Yeah,
and I think it overshadows then what is really the fact.
Right.
And
that is that we've got I don't think that any thinking person condones the looting and rioting. They may understand it as an expression of anger, but it's mostly an expression of anger.
But it becomes fuel for this, we'll call it minority position,
yes.
that says, see, that's why we can't trust black people.
Exactly.
Okay.
It is.
Yeah. Okay.
But there is also there's an inherent distrust that that's the thing that we got to keep eating away at. In elementary school, if a white kid cuts the fool, acts up, tells jokes, teacher thinks he's a high-spirited, he's a nice kid. A black kid does the same thing. He goes to the principal's office. Mm-hmm. There is still a fear among certain people that black people are somehow more dangerous than white people. Mm-hmm. That's some sort of human reaction that I'm not sure what motivates that. People always say, oh, we all want to be better than somebody. I don't know that I've ever woke up one morning and said, boy, I hope I'm better than so-and-so. Mm-hmm. But perhaps there is, mm-hmm. And so there's still a segment of people that look at black people differently. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing you hope you overcome by good examples, by intolerance of misbehavior.
And in the case of the Tallahassee bus boycott, mm-hmm. which we are then acknowledging right. and recognizing,
right.
it sometimes comes about because collectively, blacks and whites and Asians
right.
and Hispanics, we all come together and say, this is the way we want to live.
I think many white people in 1956 came to realize, why are we arguing about where they sit on the bus? they realize that this is not, that while they may not have accepted blacks as equal, while they may not have voted for them for the city commission, they could not justify being too hardcore about the idea of giving them
right.
the human dignity right. of sitting wherever they want on the bus.
Well, and interestingly, you mentioned that the next day, here were these burning crosses.
Right.
in the front yards of.
But that's been.
But think about what that impact yeah. would have had with white people
right.
who say, well, that's not me.
Malcolm Johnson,
that's not what I believe.
Yeah, the legendary editor of the Tallahassee Democrat, often accused of not being a heavy promoter of integration, and he wasn't. But he immediately seized on that, said, this is not the way we want to behave as a community. Yeah. You may disagree with the bus boycott, or you may disagree with these two girls, because
right,
it happened
right,
that quick.
Right.
You may disagree with these two girls choosing not to move, but we don't want to be a place where we could
right.
encourage violence.
Incredulous as it may seem, and as much as the Klan has not had the kind of visibility that it had at one
yeah.
time, I'm sure that it's still alive and well.
That's part of the positive
yeah.
slow movement I was talking about.
Yeah.
Talking about as whites came to realize that the bus boycott or that the riding on the buses isn't something we should be enforcing strict segregation on. From 1963 to 1968, Tallahassee, and I may be off on one of the years, but for 3, 4, 5 summers, Tallahassee pools were closed down each summer rather than allow black kids to swim in the same pools with white kids. We had 3 public pools. One of them was in the black section. The other 2, Levy Park and Myers Park, were for whites only. But protesters led by Patricia Stevens Dew, who I mentioned, would bring black kids to the city pools and try to swim. That was stopped. So by the next year, they just closed pools. They just did not open the pools at all in the summer. And eventually, white people said, now, wait a second, what? Maybe we're not going to consider them our equals. Maybe we're not going to elect them to office. But what can be wrong with their swimming in a pool, especially as hot as it is? Everybody instinctively knew Tallahassee's hot in the summer. How can you deny kids the right to swim in a pool? And again, Malcolm Johnson sort of led the way on that. He said, this is enough. This is stupid. The city commission had voted three, four times to close the pool. And he just started chiding them and saying, this is ridiculous. This is not where we make our stand about race.
Yeah. And that stand is...
And so progressively...
Onward.
Every decision that happens like that makes a new generation not use those sort of tactics and not feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, you'd be shocked. Nobody thinks twice about jumping into a pool that's already got black kids in it.
There are a lot of those things that are archaic.
Right.
And when they're
become archaic.
Yeah, brought to our attention now, especially among those who didn't live through that time,
right.
They're astounded. It's just like another planet.
Right.
You can see it. Folks, so unfortunately, we don't get to have more time with this dear man. Gerald Inslee, our guest this morning, as we recognize this 60th anniversary of the Tallahassee bus boycott back in 1956. I was a year old, by the way.
I was four.
So for those of you who may be a bit older than Gerald and I, you may were witness to all of this. God bless you. And thank you for being a part of this broadcast today. Look forward to having Gerald back on another occasion. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Folks, stay with me. I've got more coming up after the top of the hour. You're in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Truck and Hard Concepts. We're your one-stop shop for tricking out your truck. Truck and Hard Concepts. People with their cars, we're number one by far.
Tailgating starts here at Truck and Car Concepts. Get your free tailgate pong game with your purchase of any item $500 or more. A free tailgate pong game for your next tailgating party.
Truck and Car Concepts. We're your one-stop shop for tricking out.
Your free tailgate pong game this week with any purchase of $500 or more at Truck and Car Concepts across from Kraft Nissan on Mahan Drive.
Truck and Car Concepts, we're your one-stop shop, we always aim to please. Truck and Car Concepts, everything is here from A to Z.
Call 656-8800.
The most talked about topics in town. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
And we're back. We're here in the second hour of this here fine radio show. Have I mentioned to you lately that all of the broadcasts of all of these conversations that we've had now for 5.5 years, it'll be 6 years in February of 2017 that we've been on the air with you. Hard to believe that, but we're looking at thousands of folks, literally, who have come. Why would I have to say literally? Thousands of people have been here. This is not just an overstatement on my part, who have been contributing in their own right and in their own way. Everybody from the First Lady of Florida, Ann Scott, to people who are musicians, songwriters, legislators like Michelle Ray Winkle Vasselinda, or commissioners like Brian DeLoge. Educators and people like David Gusick, who is the head of music and art therapy program over there at Florida State University. And so we get the chance to meet and greet all of these fine folks who in their own way are contributing to what we know to be Tallahassee in this new time. Well, we are eager to keep all of that abreast, keep that all in front of you, so you can go to the website at any time and you can listen to any of those shows that we've brought you. You can subscribe to the podcast. Yeah. So do that, and then, you know, your podcast will, or your, you know, podcast app will automatically update your download of the most recent show. Isn't that cool? So you can listen at your leisure. You can always go to the website. If you go to the archive page and you're searching for a specific show that you want to hear, it's there for you. You can also email us, topics@tallahasseetalks.com. And that's a good way of letting us know that you have a question or you have a topic you'd like us to consider, or you just want to say hi. That's good. We like hi. You can go to our Facebook page, Tallahassee Talks on Facebook. Yep, we have a Twitter account. You can tweet us or follow us on Twitter. That's cool. See, we're hip. We got all this stuff going on so that you get a chance to participate. And as we do in that participation often, we solicit your invitation, that is to say your comments, and we invite you to be a part of that discussion. Although we are not in the business of trying to pit one against the other, we really think that it's best that we give every guest a chance to really come to us full throttle. And so it will be here with Kenneth Pratt shortly. Kenneth, for his part, an attorney, and in his work as an attorney, he is an advocate or lobbyist, as it's referred to, in the business of advocating on behalf of his client, which happens to be the banking industry here in Florida. So you might say, well, why is Kenneth Platt here? He's not a civil rights activist. Precisely. In fact, because he's a Tallahassee native, he was schooled here, attended Florida High, he's not in the employ of an organization that has that as its agenda, nor is he particularly known for his work as an activist in that capacity. He happens to be African-American, native-born, a successful professional, and in that capacity able to speak to what it is in Tallahassee in 2016 to have grown up here, to be a member of the black community, and to help all of us better appreciate what that means. What is it to be in Tallahassee, to be African American, to be a professional, and as is my interest, how are we doing? What is it that we have done that we might be able to expand on if it's worthwhile? How can we do better? How is it that as a community we are moving past this business of being represented as one of the most segregated in America? Do you not remember that Richard Florida issued this research based on the analysis of census data, and this was now about 2.5 years ago, and the title of the work is Segregated City. Tallahassee ranked number one in the nation. Based on what? Well, based on income, lifestyle, socioeconomic status, including education, yes, including race, ethnicity. So those variables that are part of that census database identifying this population, he looked at where we live, how we spend our time, who do we hang with, how are these various communities within our community brought together, if ever? What are those features of Tallahassee that make it easier, perhaps, or more convenient for all of us to participate in activities that are more broad, let's say? So why is it that you find folks in one particular part of the community, if it's dominated by black residents or if it's dominated by white residents, why do we not participate at large in activities that includes everybody? And are those activities ones that are long-term, or that is to say they've been around a long time? And I think of things like Springtime Tallahassee. You know, for many years it was a concern that the black community was not well represented in something like Springtime Tallahassee. And in fact, there was a lot of pushback. Do you not recall that there was a lot of folks in the African American community that said, "Yeah, that's not cool. We're not feeling the love." And so when you look at some of the activities of late, how about Word of South, or how about this recently presented Florida Jazz and Blues Festival? Oh, okay. Well, what about other events and festivals, the Hispanic festival that happens every year? Wow, these are newcomers to this whole business. ways in which we can participate, even structures, and I mean infrastructure, like Cascades Park and this newly opened pedestrian bridge that has come under criticism because of the expense and such, and people consider it a horrible waste. I don't, personally. I look at it and say, you know, there is a bridge to somewhere, and that where being FAMU, Gain Street area, the whole All Saints District, that connects all the way back through Cascades Park and on up to Leon High School. Does that mean anything? I think it does. Does it represent an attempt to bridge over what has been a divide between north and south in this town? I think it does. And I think when you start talking about south side Tallahassee and north side Tallahassee, and you can start pointing to that kind of architecture that says, you know what, we may have the neighborhoods that we're familiar with, but we're all ultimately connected to one another, not just in thought, not just in catchphrases, but in lifestyle and in those activities where we find common ground. It's my contention there is more that bonds us together that can ever separate us. You stay with me. I'll be right back.
American Commerce. Visionary. Hardworking. Innovative. Reaching higher. Investing more. Giving more. This is American Commerce. It's an ideal that has inspired the world to dream and believe that we can all do better. American Commerce Bank believes just that. That we can all do better. We can achieve the goals that small business owners aspire to every day. Providing these owner-managed businesses with the tools and services they count on. Creating opportunity. Providing leadership and direction to help them grow. To inspire them to believe in more. This is American Commerce Bank, right here in Tallahassee, and right now offering 2% annual percentage yield on 60-month certificates of deposit. That's reaching higher. That's American Commerce Bank. Online at AmericanCommerceBank.com. Rates are effective as of August 15, 2016, and are subject to change without notice. New money only. Minimum balance $500. APY assumes principal and interest remain on deposit until maturity. A penalty may be imposed for early withdrawal. American Commerce Bank. Equal housing lender. Member FDIC.
Good morning, friends. This is your friend, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. We're talking with Brian Cerny on Tallahassee Talks.
Kenneth Pratt is a Tallahassee native, an attorney, and an advocate, also known as a lobbyist, who within his capacity has had opportunity to speak eloquently and directedly about race and race relations, civil rights, a variety of topics that have helped to bring clarity and understanding on every occasion. As part of the observance of the 60th anniversary that recognizes the 1956 Tallahassee bus boycott, Mr. Pratt was asked to speak last week at this particular commemoration, this event. And he's quoted as saying that Tallahassee was the prototype for bus boycotts all over, and the nonviolent leadership of what Reverend Steele did was the blueprint that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would spread. Let's welcome Mr. Pratt to our broadcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Brian. Thank you for having me here today.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. He has you saying this whole effort was a blueprint. That particularly Reverend Steele was one of those organizers who said, this is how we're going to play this out. This is how it's going to go down. That blueprint, you think, is important for us right now? Can we apply that same sort of strategy in our time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What Reverend Steele and Dr. King advocated for was first of all, a nonviolent movement. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing, but they were careful to frame this movement using their economic power. Yeah. They knew, obviously, at the time that the majority of folks that rode the bus at that time were Black, and so they decided to make a statement by arranging for blacks to get rides to work or wherever they needed to go in other different ways. And that statement would be that we are not going to be treated, number one, we're not going to be treated any differently than any other white customer who comes to the bus. We just want to be treated the same way. And that is essentially the essence of the civil rights movement, is treat us, that all folks ought to be treated the same way, regardless of their race or creed.
When you look at the last 60 years, when you look at what's happened in Tallahassee, when you look at how federal mandates have been applied, and do you consider that progress? Do you think we've come forward in our efforts at an institutional level?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're actually kidding ourselves if we say there has not been progress. You know, I don't remember there being different black and white fountains, but my mother does. My mother can vividly remember when she was in college, and as she was a young professional living here in Tallahassee, there being black water fountains and white water fountains
and restrooms and
exactly
places to sit in the restaurant or on the bus.
Exactly, and many of the individuals who were a part of the bus boycott celebration last week were direct ancestors, kids, most instances, of Reverend Steele, the children of different ministers that were here in town.
Second, maybe third generation from that.
Exactly.
And yet what we're hearing and what we're seeing played out for us on the nightly news are demonstrations around the country, whether in individual communities or at a national level with something like Black Lives Matter,
right,
in which the message that I'm hearing is not about the progress that's been made, but about what remains and what is continuing in action, and especially among, let's say, law enforcement, justice system. When you were growing up in Tallahassee, were you thinking then, ah, man, this is different. This is not what my parents taught me to be. You know, in other words, there are these barriers out there that may not be institutionalized, mm-hmm, because they're illegal. Mm-hmm. You know, segregation was gone.
Right.
But there was a kind of segregation going on in the minds of those who looked at you and said, well, there's a black man who I cannot employ or who I don't want to associate with. I mean, were you aware of that going on around you as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. I one generation from that means that my parents still wanted to teach me the lessons that they had learned, which were things like, you have to be careful about who you trust. And it doesn't mean that you can only trust all black people, that you can only trust all white people. Uh-huh. You have to be careful about who you can trust. And but they also demanded that I, or encouraged me to have a certain respect for myself. And I think that, again, is a part of it. They encouraged me to do well in school, to get my education, to go further, to make a difference in my community. It wasn't solely about getting a job and working that job and making money. It was improving the lives of your community, improving the lives of others, improving the lives of those who maybe didn't have the same opportunities that you've had.
And in doing that, did you find it especially difficult because of your race? Or were you coming up against barriers in your pursuit of education, your pursuit of your career and such, or were you just so resolved that you said, I'm kicking the door
down?
Oh, no.
Oh, absolutely. There have definitely been roadblocks. I mean, my class at law school, we had several, just giving you one instance of where I've seen it in my own personal life, we had several of the African-American students that were given the honor of serving as members of our mock trial team, mm-hmm, at law school. And it just so happened in that particular year that there were several advocates who happened to be chosen who were African-American. And those advocates had only the black advocates who had made the team had their faces, or their photos defaced. This is 1996. And so we've come, don't misunderstand, we've come a long way. But that still says to me that we have a ways to go. Because here you are at a institution of higher learning. Here you are at a place where justice is to be respected, where we've all read the cases. We've all read, we know what Brown versus Board of Education said. We know what the Civil Rights Movement was about. And still at that, at this time in our history, we still have a ways to go. And so I think that is what you're seeing play out in Charlotte, in Tulsa, is that there's still a frustration that, yes, we've come some ways, but we have not, we have not come nearly far enough when it comes to some of the rather elementary aspects that we've worked so hard to move out of our lives. I mean, there have been countless civil rights leaders throughout the country, and especially in this community, who have given their lives for the right to vote, mm-hmm. who've given their, you know, just to register to vote, who've given their lives to be able to own land, to do the things that that each of us should have the right to do, that the Constitution gives us the right to do. Mm-hmm. And so, again, while we've come a long ways, I can understand the frustration of those in Tulsa and in other areas across our country when you seemingly have a situation where a young black man is killed simply with his hands up, simply for really no other reason other than there was an afraid white police officer. That's what most of these situations seem like to me. I can't come up with any other rational reason for why those situations would be happening.
Talking with Tallahassee attorney and advocate Kenneth Pratt, and you are in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back and talking with Kenneth Pratt. We've been talking a little bit about history and as it's applied to your personal history particularly, and I'm very curious as to helping me understand the complexities of, because when we talk about race relations, when we talk about prejudice, when we talk about discrimination,
sure.
Here you were at a institution of higher learning. You know, we're at Mount Olympus now. We're walking with white robes, and we're having these very elevated conversations about sure. law and justice. And you have people defacing photos of those black students who were selected to be representative in this particular mock trial. So then that says to me, there isn't a white community. There isn't a black community.
I agree.
Because here you and I sit, I'm offended to think that that happened, and I can't imagine that happening among any of the people that I know who are friends and colleagues who are white. And I hear that a lot. I hear that saying, well, they're saying the white community or the right. black community.
Right.
But there are strata. And when I look at what is happening or has been happening in Charlotte, as ignorant as I may be, I see those who are incensed and are determined to be violent and are looting.
Right.
And then I see the people who are there to make a point
right.
that are protesting and have something much more significant at hand in their minds, much more long-term than a one-night sort of thing.
Right.
What troubles me, I guess, even beyond the incidents of violence, is how that then is used to characterize what is otherwise a legitimate point.
Sure.
So the bus boycott of 1956 in Tallahassee didn't end that way.
Right.
There was no violence.
Right.
But it worked. And it worked because people were persistent in their determination to stay on point.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the other reasons I think it worked, Brian, is because the bus boycott used everyday regular folks. It used some students who simply were working. They were there were folks that worked, and they also went to school. But it used them as examples that everyone could identify with. I think that's why you saw with the bombing of those young girls in that church. Uh-huh. That was something that the community uh-huh. gathered around,
yeah.
not just African Americans,
right.
not just Black folks.
Right. Right.
That the community had to say this was a horrible tragedy,
right.
and I think that's the shift in our culture that we need to get to, where it does offend me when I see someone who is gay or bisexual being discriminated against.
Uh-huh.
It should offend me if I see Black folks that are discriminating against you. That should be offensive to each mm-hmm. of us. And I think that is, again, the effectiveness of what Dr. King and Reverend Steele and those other leaders of the civil rights movement understood.
Mm-hmm.
They understood that it was going to take regular, everyday folks who everyone could relate to make the point that they should be treated the same as anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And yet your parents were clear with you in saying, if I'm not mistaken, Kenneth, it's not enough for you to be as good as. You have to excel because you're going to carry the additional burden of the fact that you are African American among some circles anyway.
Yes.
Apparently. Where your achievement is going to have to demonstrate the value you bring to the situation.
Sure.
And you've done that. And you're saying that a lot of African American people live that same way. They know that they have to be better than just good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It is something that is there is a difference between the reality and the way that things are mm-hmm. and the way we are moving, the way that we would like things to be.
Sure.
And I think what my parents were teaching to was the reality. They were teaching to the fact that there is still discrimination in our country. And as we previously talked about, they had the opportunity to see Jim Crow. They had to experience it. My father was one of a few Black students over at Florida State when he was getting his PhD at Florida State. You know, my mother was in the same situation, getting her master's in library science at Florida State. Many of the folks who I've come in contact with and had the privilege of working with, Fred Flowers, a wonderful attorney here in town, one of the first Black students at Florida State's undergraduate institution. Those are folks who I think understood that by excelling, they could be really show that not only could African Americans do well or get into the schools, but they could do well. They could mm-hmm. do excellent, mm-hmm. And so. Looking at the history, looking at everything that has occurred down through the ages in this city specifically, there's still, once again, there's still work to be done. And myself and I think others are dedicated, yourself, we're all dedicated to getting there. And I think this also, what's also important is that we have to continue this conversation.
If it's necessary for us to continue, then that begs the question, what is it that's left undone? And we'll just talk about Tallahassee.
Again, in my own experiences and growing up in this community, it's very clear to me that you know we have an African American, a young African American mayor in our town. However, there are we saw the response to him and the response that was gathered when he was questioned about several different decisions that were made in regards to the Hermine efforts, relief efforts, if you will, and how that played out. I mean, that had racial backgrounds and racial tinges, as well as political tinges. And ultimately, I think what we're talking the same language. What I would like to see, what I'm hopeful for my kids in the future, is that, and what I'm teaching them, and I hope each of us will teach our children is exactly what you said, that we are each humans and you are dealing with another human being.
That's an interesting point, and that got past me because I was privy to a lot of those conversations between the governor and the mayor. It was not difficult to have access to those conversations because they were going viral.
Right.
I didn't catch the racial component there.
Oh,
what did you notice that I did not see?
Well, I think at least coming from the Black community, yeah, and specifically, that was why you had a group of African-American pastors come out and speak on behalf of the mayor to say that that number one, the mayor's response was something that was positive. Oh. It was something that would move our city forward, and I think what we saw was, in a very subtle way, a reminder that a young African-American male perhaps was maybe not ready to run the city. And instead of Governor Scott, quite frankly, going to Mayor Gillum and saying, well, Mayor, we understand X, Y, and Z is happening. How can we fix this? As a human being would, yeah, from my understanding, there were press releases that were issued,
yeah, yeah,
and it became a political issue.
Yeah.
And along those same political lines, a certain racial tinge there, dealing with a white governor, white Republican governor, and a Black Democratic mayor.
The racial, you say there was a racial tinge there, had not occurred to me. Maybe, see again, you're seeing it from your perspective.
Correct.
And that fascinates me because I'm like, how did I miss that?
Well,
I listened for that kind of thing.
Sure, know? Sure. And perhaps again, you're talking about a different perspective, yeah, that you have that you're coming from that I come from than from what I come from. But I think there's a certain level of sensitivity that we all should have. And it goes right back to the same conversation we're having about viewing other human beings as human beings. And I disagree with you to a degree that, you know, and we don't necessarily know the exact answer to this, but would Governor Scott, because of who he is, would he have felt it? Would he have felt more comfortable with going to a white mayor who maybe was with his same party and,
yeah,
saying,
yeah,
I would like to help resolve these issues, and this is how let's work together.
So you're
to do
asking
that.
The question as perhaps more so than just making that judgment. You're saying, hey, wait a minute, what was really in play here?
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Was it politics?
Was it politics?
Was it race?
I mean,
correct.
Republican white versus Democrat Black. You know, I love the fact that we're even questioning this because to me, this is the national narrative right now.
Absolutely.
When we look in on a situation from not just 30,000 feet, 100,000 feet, we're looking in on Charlotte. Folks, you see, this is where we're at. And these are the kind of conversations that we want to continue to have on behalf of not just this issue, but all the things that we talk about. You stay with me. I've got Kenneth Pratt. He's hanging in. He's doing the very best he can to stay right where he is. Folks, you're in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. We'll be right back.
Hello, brothers and sisters in Radio Land. This is blues guitarist Jerry Thigpen. Don't you move, because this is Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
So we're back doing the very best we can between Kenneth and I when we start talking about perceived events or how it is that we perceive and apply to those things that occur a kind of predisposition, a kind of prejudgment, a kind of, if you want to call it, attitude, the filters, right, that are just part of the human condition, I suppose, because it's easier for us. I mean, we just get lazy. You know, where do you buy your groceries? Same store every time. Okay, well, you ever thought about going across the street? Why would I do that? Well, because over there they've got XYZ. Well, I don't know what that is. Right. So maybe if you would take my hand and we go across the street, let me introduce you to that new thing. And that's exactly why I've invited Kenneth to help me here, because he's a very gentle man. I've already come to that conclusion.
Well, thank you.
He's brilliant and he's educated. He's committed. and now you owe me $5. No. he's willing to have this conversation.
And
that's the most important part.
That's something that you're hitting on exactly something that we talk about in politics all the time. Mm-hmm. And that is not being afraid to have the debate. Mm-hmm. We have to stop being afraid to have the debate. When you disagree with someone on a topic, it can, you know, a lot of times as an advocate in the legislative process, I'm on the other side of the table from someone who holds a different view. But sometimes sitting in that room until we figure out a solution that will help us both be able to move forward with whatever our interests is or our interests are, that is something that is key to the human. It's key to our society. It's what right. What's been done in the history of our society is right. folks sitting down to talk about what their issues are.
Right.
Dr. King did it with LBJ, you know, and they came out with the Civil Rights Act. You know, that those were the kinds of things that have improved our country. Whenever we sit down and begin to have the debate about differing views and how we can get on the same page and both live with that.
Sure, sure. These days, with all that you do within your practice, and I mean in your role as advocate, a lobbyist for your client, and I think you said earlier that you represent the banking industry as such.
Correct.
When you get involved in these kinds of conversations, is it more academic? Are you asked to speak at the kinds of events that you did last week there at Trinity United Methodist? I mean, how do you play out your participation in this conversation at large?
Well, I think part of it is that people in our community see me as not just a lobbyist who goes to work and comes home every day and earns a paycheck.
An expectant father, I should add.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you. But they see me as someone who's working to improve our community, who's willing to have and start conversations that may be a little uncomfortable in the beginning.
And how do you do that? Where do you go to have those conversations?
You go places like this, like where we are right now. Okay. And
so I'm not your first radio show?
You're not my first radio show, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
but there are a number of different outlets, a number of different places where... I feel as though me being in the room, me being presenting a different perspective, perhaps, that normally would not be there, that's crucial. Okay. And it goes back to, again, what I said previously about finding your voice. Each of us have a role to play. Each of us, you know, it's not going to be the same for everybody, and it's not right. going to be high profile. Not everybody's going to get lauded for yeah. some of the things that they do. But that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is to bring together our communities. And if I can just make one other
please,
point, Brian,
please.
I think that, again, going back to our conversation about the civil rights movement here in Tallahassee,
right.
that is what Reverend Steele understood. That is what Dr. King understood, that it was a collective effort. It wasn't just African-American students. It was a lot of African-American students and predominantly African-American students. But there were also some white students yep. who did not want to stand for or knew that what was happening with the Tallahassee white students and white patrons being treated differently than white black patrons.
Yeah.
They knew that that was wrong. And so they took a stand.
Yeah.
And again, finding your voice is important. I'm still finding my voice, but I certainly believe that each of us play a role in that conversation. And when we collectively pull our efforts together, that is what makes a difference. So it's not just the doctors or the lawyers or the engineers or the radio folks. It is a community of folks who are pulling together and speaking the same language about not just civil rights, but about community rights, really.
And do you blog? Are you a blogger? Are you publishing? I mean, how do we stay in touch with you?
Not currently. I've been working on some autobiographical things that I'd like to publish eventually.
Okay.
I am always available to speak to groups.
Right.
Always willing, more than willing, to speak to groups of young people. That's what my real passion is.
Okay. So you're there by invitation more often than by you inserting yourself in a given situation.
Okay. Correct. Okay. Correct.
Well, that's because you're a gentleman, you know, and you're polite.
Well,
but you seem to be pretty lucid in your understanding of the issues and able to bring clarity. When you are in that position, do you see yourself in the middle trying to reach out to black and white simultaneously, or are you more advocating on behalf of the black perspective?
Well, I think I'm advocating on behalf of a human perspective.
Oh.
And wanting us to, and I'm more than anything, I think my legal background is probably coming in there, because and I mentioned this in my remarks to the group on the anniversary, that collaborate, we have to begin to come together to talk more often. One of the things that the mayor has done, I think that's been wonderful, is having a day of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's associated with the celebration of Dr. King's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been pleased to be a part of that. And certainly again this year we'll be a part of the MLK Dare to Dream festival that's happening in January, and hopefully would love to have you interview Kimberly Minchin, who is actually the executive director for the foundation, and she is a powerful person who had a vision that we would celebrate Dr. King, number one, but then number two, that we would talk about the dreams that we have for our country, the dreams that we have for our community. And that's really where I see myself is putting myself there to talk about that conversation. Let's have the debate. I loved debate when I was in high school, by the way. And I think once we sit down and start to have the conversation, have the debate of different perspective, of different views, we're all the better because of it.
He is a local attorney, Kenneth Pratt, our guest today. He has been recognized for his contributions in many ways, and most recently his participation in this 60th anniversary recognition of the 1956 Tallahassee bus boycott. Our guest this morning, Mr. Pratt, indeed a pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
It's been all my pleasure. Thank you.
Folks, that's what we have for you today. Thanks for being with me. It's our pleasure to bring you Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny every Saturday. We continue with this effort, and we'll be on again tonight at 9:30 with a repeat broadcast on moosemagnificat.com, and again Wednesday at 5:30 on Moose. I'll be looking for you again next week. Our executive producer is Carl Cerny. Our associate producer is Andrew Rybeck. And I will be here next Saturday looking for you. So come on, Tallahassee, come talk to me.
Witten Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. When you call Witten Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Witten's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Witten Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. Witten Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.